Well, hello, everybody. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ, and you're tuned in to another exciting, magical episode of the Midnight Mass Podcast. But before we can go any further, allow me to introduce my teeny tiny little green friend, the one, the only, Michael Verratti.
Whether filmmaker or vicious hag, podcast host or queen of drag, I don't care if you're young or old, you'll never get me pot of gold. Hello, hello, Peaches.
Oh my God, that was a surprise. Wow. When did you write that?
Like 5 minutes before we got on the air.
Well, it's very, very well done. Now, I cannot promise that that's going to be the last of our attempt at an Irish accent. So for all of the people we could probably offend out there, all of you Irish folk, or anyone who's interested in accents, we're imitating the title character of this movie. We're not imitating Irish people. We're imitating the monster of the film, which leads me to this question, Michael. What is the film? What is this mysterious, magical film that we're alluding to?
Well, I know it's super obscure and not obvious at this point, but we're talking about 1993's Leprechaun, written and directed by Mark Jones and starring Warwick Davis, Jennifer Aniston, Mark Holton, Ken Olant, and, you know, lots of clovers and gold and little buckle shoes.
We have a little bit to talk about where we're going to pull back the velvet curtain, as it were, my beef curtains. We're going to pull back my beef curtains so you can see deep inside the inner workings of the Midnight Mass Podcast, because unlike other episodes where things go awry or things don't go as planned, we just sort of put it all together and the show must go on and we present you with a finished product. But because of the way this show kind of went awry a little bit, we're going to share it with you now. That doesn't mean that anything went wrong. It just means things didn't go according to plan. And originally, we had anticipated and planned for, and actually were about to release this episode way back in March during St. Patrick's Day. And due to a technical issue when the show was output and really finished, I mean, we had finished the entire episode, there was a question around one of the interviews we did, whether or not the recording quality was of a caliber that we could stand by. Mostly, it wasn't. It was hard to understand. And so we had to re-record a chunk of this episode. And here we are months later putting it out.
You know, we care enough about your listening that we didn't want you to feel like you were listening to a whole segment of our show as if you had had many pints of green beer. So here we are doing it right, doing right by you. But by now, folks are aware that we record the show in segments. We do interviews, we do interstitials, and none of those are really done on the same day because of the way we build the show. And so this show, much like a TV show or a film or any other production, some productions are smooth and some productions are not. And this just happened to be a hiccup episode that still, I think, in the end, even though it took us a little longer, turned out great. I'm really happy with the content of this episode and the interviews that we have. I guess maybe going back to your original point for our attempts at Irish accents, maybe we saved ourselves by being not too offensive because it's no longer St. Patrick's Day.
We don't want to rub salt in the wounds on the high holy day of drunkenness. So yes, this movie is a doozy, and we really appreciate it. I know that I enjoyed this film when it first came out, mostly because my sidekick back in the day, Martini, God rest her. Actually, she's still alive. It just feels like she's dead. Martini, my flawed and tragic sidekick, saw this movie before I did, and she was like, you have to see this movie. Oh my God, it's amazing. She loved Leprechaun. She is kind of a leprechaun. She's kind of the leprechaun of drag in a way.
You know, that's true. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But she ran around doing Where's Me Gold, you know, for weeks after seeing this, which of course then meant I went to the theater and saw it. An immediate appreciation because let's face it, Michael, this is a weird one.
I think that while we lost the timeliness of St. Patrick's Day, this whole year is ripe for the celebration of Leprechaun because this year is its 30th anniversary. And when you think back to 1993, when the original Leprechaun was released, we're coming off the heels of the slasher boom of the 80s. We had Freddy, we had Jason, we had Michael, we had Pinhead, and it was sort of entering that era where horror was in a transition period. We hadn't quite gotten to Scream and sort of the reclamation of slashers, et cetera, et cetera. And this era of horror is unique because they threw a lot of stuff at the wall to see what would stick. And Leprechaun is an early outing there. Of course, we get Warlock and Tremors and such later. Well, maybe not later, but around the same time. But Leprechaun's one of those where it kind of leans into the comedy of Freddy while having sort of like a B-movie appeal. And it worked for audiences because from this film, we get many, many sequels and sort of an ongoing fandom. I know Lionsgate is developing yet another Leprechaun as we sit and speak. And it's interesting because it seems like an underdog, really, when it came out.
It is fascinating to see the big heavy hitter franchises not necessarily have the same consistent sustainability that some of these sort of dark horses do in the world of 80s slasher genre and horror movies. You could make an argument that it's the little guys, literally. Chucky and Leprechaun. Of course, we've seen the return of Hellraiser recently, but that was after a pretty long break. But if you look at consistency, Chucky and Leprechaun, there might be an argument that these two were the most consistent. You know, Freddy's disappeared for many, many years at a time. Jason would go away, although Jason's coming back in the form of a television show. But I think Chucky and Leprechaun tend to be maybe two of the most consistent as far as content being output on a regular basis. And yeah, I mean, speaking of more recent content, we've got, you know, one of our interviews who can speak to that, of course. And we are focusing the show, even though this is a giant subject, we're focusing the show primarily on the first film, but this episode delves into the bigger picture, the world of Leprechaun.
During the St. Patrick's Day onslaught and March holiday season, we happen to see some legit drag royalty show off some Leprechaun looks that caught our attention. And we knew in planning the celebration, we had to ask him to come on the show. He is the legendary winner of the Boulay Brothers Dragula season 3, one of the most storied drag kings in all of dragdom. It's Landon Sider, and we're talking to him about all things Leprechaun right now.
Okay, everybody. Well, it is my extreme pleasure and great honor to introduce our next guest, royalty, true royalty, very magical, and someone that I am a huge fan of, truly. I was familiar with his work before he exploded all over everywhere, internationally, through his appearance, not just as a competitor, but as the winner of the Boulay Brothers Dragula season 3. I'm happy to say I might have had a small little hand in helping that happen because he blew me away on the episode I was lucky enough to get to judge. But I continue to be blown away by his looks, his talent. His social media is incredible. It's always inspiring. He's also the host and producer of the monthly drag show Diverse. He's here today to discuss this film with us for obvious reasons if you follow his social media. But without further ado, it's the one, the only, it's Landon Sider.
Hi. That intro was so great. It was so clear, too. It was, I magically blew you and then exploded all over everyone.
I mean, hello. You're a drag king, you know. So let's have you explode everywhere. Yeah.
And speaking of magic that comes from the rainbow, we're here.
Swing it back around. I love it.
Wow. I told you.
Great.
He's gonna keep us on track. Yeah.
To talk about the Leprechaun, and one of the ways that Peaches and I discovered your enthusiasm for this cult classic is because you took to Instagram this season in the most amazing Leprechaun drag.
Thank you.
So I'm assuming that you don't do drag as the Leprechaun unless you love the Leprechaun.
Right.
where did it begin? When did you first see this movie, decide you love it, et cetera?
Like it did most people our age, and cause incredible childhood trauma upon first watching it. And then, like most horror fans, you just turn that trauma into glee and like you just hyper focus into why did that fuck me up? That's why I love it so much. Yeah, really just fucked me up as a kid. And then, well, not as a kid, like as an early teenager, really, which is kind of where it kind of started. But yeah, I've always loved it. I always loved how like horrible and bad it is in such a great way, and how cheeky it is and how grotesque it is too. And I love how the gory bits kind of don't match in line with the whole tone of the movie. There's kind of these gory bits kind of come out and you're like, whoa, that was unexpected. But I love that too. And I've always loved, like, big fans of Nightmare and Child's Play and stuff. And it's very much in line with those films. So it just kind of continued my love of campy horror and, like, fantasy horror and magical horror.
Well, I actually am glad that you brought up Nightmare and Child's Play, because I think as drag performers and cult movie lovers, I mean, certainly one of the things that I've done as Peaches Christ has been to do drag interpretations or Peaches interpretations of, God, I've done Chucky, I've done Freddy, I've done Pinhead. But I think you're the first person I've ever seen to tackle Leprechaun. And not only did you tackle it, but like you really looked like him. Thank like you. This wasn't some loosey-goosey, you know, where you see those bitches put on like a fedora hat and wear like a red and green striped sweater dress. And they're like, I'm Freddy. Right. It's like, no, honey, you need to do a little bit more. I want to start there because I think the makeup design for the character is fabulous. I think we all agree the performance is fabulous, mm-hmm. You know. He's clearly what makes this series sing. And you're just so good at makeup. How did you figure out how to do that? I want to get nerdy. And what level is shading versus prosthetics? How do you do it?
Well, it's actually a really basic way of making prosthetics where it's just cotton ball and liquid latex. I wanted to try to make it a more top-notch fine-tune, but it's so crusty and wrinkly, his skin, that yeah. It really lent itself to that kind of like elementary version of prosthetics. So I just got cotton balls and molded it and layered it with liquid latex and kept adding to it. So it is really like a full prosthetic. It's elf ears, and then it's a full piece that touches up around my nose and goes under my eyes, and it's my whole chin and nose, I mean, and jawline and chin. And then it's a full forehead prosthetic that goes up over half my hair, so that in case my hat comes off during the performance, you'll still see that I have like a deep hairline. I'm so like so perfectionist about that shit, because in live performances, shit happens. And if the hat comes yeah. off and then you see the bobby pins and all like the bullshit, I'm like, oh, that gives away the illusion. And I want, if my hat falls off, I want to be able to be like, yeah, bitches, I got that covered under there too. And what?
So, yeah.
Well, let's be honest. Being a perfectionist can win you a crown.
I mean, I guess. but it is where the edges meet is definitely still shading and things. But the paint job alone on the prosthetic is really what elevates it into looking like him. And just to, like, side note, I'm a cosplayer. When I do cosplays, I do try to aim to look exactly like the character or the person. That's something I pride myself on. But I am incredibly inspired by those people who do blends of their own aesthetic. And I know when someone's being like, all right, you're being cheap about it, or you're being like not uninspired. Okay, I see what you're doing though, girl. But I really love it when people bring their own vibe into those cosplays too. I think that's can be even more creative and with the creativity of how they could do that. But I'm a fan of trying to look like the person.
You did.
I'm really thrilled that you brought up Chucky and Freddy as well, but not for the reasons that Peaches was, although I am very fascinated by this process and it feels very daunting because of the three of us, I do not do makeup the way that you two do, or really at all. So I'm just bow at the altar of what you both achieve. But what I want to talk about is the fact that I think for a generation of queer viewers, people like Freddy and Chucky and the Leprechaun hone in on something that other horror antagonists don't. When you think about Jason or Michael Myers or some of these sort of like stoically silent, lumbering figures. They're scary and they're interesting. But what is Freddy? What is Chucky? What is the Leprechaun? If not theatrical, mm-hmm. if not other and whimsical, there's a humor and a kind of like a playful nastiness. And I'm wondering specifically through the queer lens, if that's also part of the draw, even if we didn't realize it at the time.
Oh, I say for sure. I feel like that Broadway, that theatricality that comes out, you're just like, oh, that's so gay. It's just so gay. And even though the character's not like assigned gay as a character, it's still fucking gay. It's good. I mean, I think everything's gay though. I think sporks are gay. So don't ask me about what gay is, but everything's gay.
Basically, that is this entire podcast. I think there's a lot of cult film fans and horror fans that tune into our podcast because Michael and I are, you know, we're selling a cult film podcast and horror podcast. And then they're basically like, this is just all about how queer everything is.
It really is. Yeah.
It's true. Every week, like, we'll start on something and we'll be like, you know what's queer? This. Uh-huh. And you just know collectively there's some listener out there that's like, oh, shit, here they go again.
Uh-huh. We traffic in cult and camp and kitsch and. So of course it's going to be a recurring theme, and we're as queer people obviously attracted to cult movies because they speak to the otherness of our experience. Mm-hmm. So there is a reason for it. Speaking of queerness and gay people, you, Landon Sider,
uh-oh,
are a woman who has a wife.
Yes, I do.
Jennifer Aniston, hot for her. You like her in this movie because. I feel like with Scream Queens, she's an odd entry. We don't often think of her, probably because she went on to become such a huge movie star. But when you think about so did Jamie Lee Curtis. I mean, she just won an Oscar, but we think of Jamie Lee Curtis as like a Scream Queen. You know, Heather Langenkamp in A Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm just wondering, like, as a young queer girl, were you like into any of these people, specifically Jennifer Aniston?
No, I've always liked Latina women, so I never really saw her as like a hottie or anything. I really was really focused on like the supporting characters and the Leprechaun himself. Really, like, I liked the buddy characters of of Ozzy and what was his name, Alex. I really like their kind of chemistry the most, and Leprechaun as a character. The rest of it were kind of just fluff for me and moved the story along really more than anything. And the fact that Jennifer Aniston is a Leprechaun denier kind of.
She is. She's a Leprechaun denier. Yeah. She's a flat earther.
I mean, I've heard her talk about it, but I don't think she like talks about it with zest.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I get it. You know,
that's funny.
You would think all those years of friendship with Courtney Cox would be like, girl, embrace the horror because the horror will embrace you.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
One thing we do mention on the show, and I will say, is Jennifer Aniston, someone I definitely kind of slept on as far as like, I wasn't really a big fan of Friends, didn't really care about it. I still don't think it's very funny, you know, and I have friends who love it and think it's wonderful. But I saw the show she does with Reese Witherspoon that's on Apple TV where she plays like the morning show host.
Yeah, I think it's called Morning Show.
Oh, okay. She is so good. She is so talented. And then going back and watching Leprechaun, she's good. Yeah. Like, I will give her that. She is a good performer. I mean, it's a silly script, but you're right. My favorite character is Ozzy and the Leprechaun. Yeah. You know, like, they're the best characters in the movie.
They really are.
What's your favorite gore moment in the movie? You know, movies like this are about the kills.
Yeah. I think the part that made me just squirm and just kind of went, was when he got his eye gauged out and then he went and got the cop's eye and then just put it back, popped it back in his own head. I thought it didn't have like practical effects like I really love, because I love practical effects. But it still had it enough where it made me clench my butthole just like watching him, you know?
Yes.
That's the first thing that came to mind, but really all of them are so... Oh, the pogo.
The pogo's pretty great.
Oh, the pogo.
And then he ends it with, he'll bounce back soon enough or something along those lines. It's so good.
Yeah, it's so good.
Now that I think about it, the pogo's pretty good.
And then, as with most horror films that spawn sequels upon sequels, the ante gets upped. The silliness gets upped. Where do you exist with your relationship with the sequels to Leprechaun? Do you like those?
I do. I have most memories about the first one because I've watched that one a handful of times, probably more than that. But I do have, like, you know, the In the Hood and Back in the Hood. Those are just so good. And they're just, how do you think of that and then draw it and then just have all of these iconic moments of him rapping so bad? He's such a bad rapper, but it's so good. I don't think I've actually finished In Space all the way through. I couldn't say that I've seen the whole film.
Of relevant interest to listeners of this podcast, In Space features a drag performance. At some point in the movie, the leprechaun, using its magic, turns one of the space marines into a drag queen who's not just like a space marine in drag. He does like a number and then attacks them.
Oh my God, how did I miss that? Now I want to go back and watch it just for that.
I don't know if it's a good drag performance.
They never are.
No, but it's there.
I also had not seen Space, but now maybe you've just inspired me to, you know, when they get to the point where they're going in space, with, I think the exception being, I do really like that Friday the 13th where they go to space. I know that not everyone likes it. I personally like it. I think it has one of the best kills. The frozen face gag in that movie is just so amazing. But I digress. I do like that you brought it back to drag, though, Michael, because it made me think and realize Landon not only does the social media of it all, which is so great, because I'm not hip to any of that. The idea of sitting and talking and doing makeup on a live or something just terrifies me. I don't even remember to take photos of my shit. You know, I'm terrible. But you're so good at the social media, but you're also a producer and a live performer. And you mentioned you were worried about the hat falling off. So take us through your leprechaun performance. I want to know, like, what did you do as Leprechaun?
Oh, it's definitely high camp with elements of horror, but it's more like my look is so horrific. Like, it's it. Some of the people can't watch me. They're literally looking down the whole time because of the PTSD that I'm giving them,
right?
Which is my favorite. But it's really just me, like, hopping around and having my shoulders hunched and my arms, and then I have my bag of gold that I'm looking for my gold. So my hands are so big that I can't really interact with the audience with my hands. So I'm just holding and then, like, give me money. And I do money. That's what I want.
All right.
Bunch of audio bits from the movie that then go into the next song. Like the regular formula of drag performance.
Oh, you are smart, because any number like that, you've just quadrupled your tips.
Yes, bitch.
Right?
And because smart. I build up my shoulders so big so that it gives me that body shape that I need, I always tell them that I need you to tip me because I need to pay for all my shoulder pads that I put into this costume. yeah, and it has some, like, Lucky Star, a little bit of Lucky Star by Madonna. It has his rap from In the Hood. Oh. 24 Karat Magic from, you know, and it kind of just goes along some of the funny bits of the movie and some of the things he says and goes right into a song that makes sense, whatever. He's just a little Danny Boy, a little punk rock version of Danny Boy.
Perfect.
Smoke weed every day, you know, some little gags here and there. It's a really long mix too, so I get really exhausted because I'm not a dancer. And me having to, like, hop around the whole time and, like, yell, like, like, the whole time is exhausting.
Yeah.
I love that we started the conversation about the PTSD of the leprechaun, and you mentioned that you get that reaction from audience members.
Yes.
Because I think that coming out of the 80s and that kind of, like, big, big run of horror movies that we got in the 80s, the early 90s were, like, a strange time. So we weren't getting kind of the volume of horror films or horror icons. Mm-hmm. For, like, a period of time in the pre-Scream era, Leprechaun was one of the few franchises that was really out there. What's interesting about it is that in retrospect, as adult people, you think back on it and you're like, how were we ever scared of this? But I know so many kids that were shook by the leprechaun that it's fascinating that grip is still holding for audience members.
It is. And when I rewatched it with that kind of reminder of how I was giving people a reaction, I rewatched it in its entirety for this, just so I can make sure I had a refresher. And the whole, like, the first, like, what, 20 minutes has him sounding like a little kid asking for help in a little cute little voice. And that's, okay, children by themselves, alone, horrifying. add that as a leprechaun pretending to be a child, even more scary. And then you're trapped in a box. You're like, please help me. And then this thing pops out at you. Like, that's traumatizing when you're a child, hearing your voice asking for help and then having a leprechaun jump up at you, like ready to kill you. Yeah, I see. That's pretty traumatizing. And I think that's why one of the scarier things about Nightmare on Elm Street is the fact that you have these kids singing this song that's so iconic, and it's the children's voices. And I just think kids are scary. You put them in a movie and you make them sound like they need help, and it makes it even scarier.
It's why the legacy of Children of the Corn is so strong. It's like, there's nothing scarier than killer children, you know, the Brood, Village of the Damned, you know, all of that is just so great. And, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, I think the first one is just scary. I mean, it's scary. It's got creativity. It is fantastic, but it's a horror movie. Freddy is scary. You know, his quips are meant to send shivers. You know, he's gross. He's scary. Part two, part three. Part three, he starts to get sassy. And it's fun. And he's smart and sassy. Part four, a little sassier. Then it kind of jumps the shark, where the series then leans way more into comedy than it does horror. And what I love about Leprechaun is out the gate, it's coming out in a post-Freddy Krueger world. They want this killer to have sassy little quips and to be clever and funny. But what I love about Leprechaun is he's still scary.
Yeah.
And he's little, you know. So in many ways, they do these things that I would think make it more challenging for the horror of it all. He's small, which I think Chucky has that issue as well. That makes it less scary. And he's being kind of funny, but there's something wicked about him that's actually just scary.
And not just his makeup, and it's not just his voice. Also, the camera angles, I think, really help you with that, because they really drop really low to really see his perspective. And that can kind of, like, it's jarring for people who never put themselves in that place of being that little. And I think to kind of like see it and then to be back in the perspective of the adult size other than Alex, you know, but like just having that perspective change, I think, can add to that scary too. I think also the creators might be like foot fetish or shoe fetish people, because there's so many cuts of the shoes walking of like every single character. I fucking love it.
We talked about this a little bit with our other guests, but Freddy is obviously a truly terrifying figure who has these kind of quippy moments, but there are rules to Freddy. Like, you know, if you watch the franchise, you know how to beat Freddy at a certain point. And similar with some of these, you could just kind of like field punt Chucky if you need to get away. The Leprechaun, basically, as we are told through the rules of the movie, is all powerful. You know, his magic is without limits. And his true weakness, ultimately, is capitalism. Like, you know, he is this creature who, like, he can be defeated because he wants to hoard wealth.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm fascinated by that. Like, the true Noah, like, he has got a bag of gold, but he needs all of it.
Yeah.
And that's how you beat him. And I'm sort of like, well, in today's world, in 2023, where we're really having some economic discussions, like, the Leprechaun makes more sense of is a villain than ever. I don't even have a question. I'm just saying, this is the bad guy. It's the Leprechaun hoarding wealth.
That is so cool. And he doesn't even want to give one. He's like, I'm missing the coin. 99. Where's the other one? Like, I need 100.
in some ways, it makes him even more interesting, because unlike the Jason or Freddy, where there's sort of this morality to it, like they're getting revenge for something, some wrong that had been done to them, the Leprechaun doesn't really, it's not personal. He's not mad at you. He just wants his fucking money. And if you stand in the way of it, like, all you have to do to survive is let go of your greed. That's really it. He's not necessarily out to punish people. He just wants that money, which I think is different. And another reason that I enjoyed the series. Landon, I thought about, what are the things I have been dying to ask you outside of Leprechaun? And I want to say that I need more mariachi vampire. As a horror icon such as you are, that was one of the most inspired things I've seen on any drag performer anywhere, television, stage, you know. Love that character. So was the mariachi vampire that you presented in Dragula on TV Was that something that was born on Dragula, the TV show? Had you done the character before? And are there plans to do more with the character? Because I speak for many when I say we love the vampire.
Well, thank you. That's one of my personal favorites. Of course, you know, the werewolf daddy gets a lot of attention. yeah, Mariachi is a close second from a lot of people I talk about. I was born for Dragula. I do perform a lot of like Mexican characters when it comes to my regular stage performance. Like I have a Cholo character that's like super popular. I do it almost every night of wherever I'm performing, at least in Southern California, or like regionally it goes well. Well, like when I went into Dragula, I knew I wanted to bring all elements of what I do with drag. And that's camp, that's horror, that's like a little bit of everything, including political. I perform a lot of political. It's ingrained into my drag a lot of times. Even if it's not in your face, it's still there. And I wanted to bring something that was cultural, but also a little political. So once I got that like breakdown, I knew exactly what I was going to go with. And I actually had an accordion that was going to be my instrument. And I had put like phone clay on the keys so that the keys of the accordion were finger like bones instead. And then I was going to rip it open and blood was going to pour out from my accordion and like body parts and stuff. And they gave us a twist of a fan so that I knew I needed to get rid of my accordion, turn my fan into the instrument. And then I added a little hose for the glitter that popped up and made it all iconic and shit. But
yeah,
I'm excited to bring him back somehow once I could fit back into the costume.
Oh, I know all about that.
COVID really added a lot of fluff to my body and I haven't quite got rid of it yet. So I haven't been able to fit into a lot of my costumes, especially Dragula costumes. I can't even put one leg on.
I hear you, sister. I hear you.
Yeah. One thing I want to add to this, because I was on set for every challenge of season 3. So you and I got to see a lot of each other. Yes. But one thing that I don't know that viewers really get to realize, especially with regard to these looks that we're talking about, is how much detail you put into everything. There are things on the show that people would comment on, viewers, that they recognize the details, but for everything I feel like they saw, there were things that they didn't, because you are so thoughtful about everything that you do. It's incredible. Like, I always think about the trash challenge where you created that mermaid with the different bits of trash, and you had a story. It wasn't just a look. You had created a whole story. And so I'm curious, because we've never really had a chance to talk about this. When you craft a look like that, is story important to you?
Hands down. I very rarely do a look first and then try to match a song to it. It's all based on the song, the story of the song, the emotion, and whatever that character is feeling during the arc of the song. If there's a reveal, it's going to be a reveal that is in tune with the story of the character, whatever the character's feeling at the time. It's all head to toe. Every detail is what would that character bring? Why would that character put that on? All from an actor's perspective. And of course, as drag artists, we're our own directors and choreographers and everything. So it's very much head to toe story. How does this all apply? And Dragula is what I love about it, is that it allows you to really take these stories as opposed to like other competitions who don't care about the story so much all the time. It's just about the fashion, which is great, but that's not really what I do. I'm not a fashion king. I'm a story king. I'm a character king. So it's all about how the costume applies to the story of the character.
And just to gush, one thing I really appreciated in talking about the television shows and the wider popularity of this drag explosion that we're experiencing, and of course the backlash that we're experiencing now, which is just so nuts and so insane. And Michael and I have discussed it some on the podcast. But, you know, one of the really beautiful things about Dragula for me is that Drag Race, I'll just say it, Drag Race just didn't really showcase very well the sort of drag world that I am part of, or that I helped create in San Francisco, this sort of wild punk rock, horror filled, you know, theatrical drag world. And so it was frustrating kind of watching it going like, hey, everyone, that you think this is what drag is all about, but it's only one sliver of drag. And that show does that sliver very well. And I enjoy the talent. I mean, I'm friends with so many of the talented people. But then Dragula comes along and shows a bigger part of the sliver, a sliver that I relate to more. And you, as a king, I think really, one, you had the weight of the world on your shoulders because you knew how marginalized kings are, even in the drag world. You know, I mean, it, you know, I hate to say it. Now, San Francisco, I think we're a little bit more fortunate because drag is really, it's just all over the map.
It's really wild.
But still, I'm friends with a lot of AFAB performer women, performers, and a lot of kings who just don't get the same opportunities and don't get to showcase their stuff as much. And you nailed it. And you won fair and square. You got on that show and you presented your art and you won. So how does it feel like to have been that sort of breakthrough moment for kings? And how are the kings now responding to you? And, you know, like, you're kind of like the king of all kings at this point, you know?
Well, thank you for one, for saying that I have the weight on my shoulders, because a lot of people don't recognize that, or at least recognize it to me. It was very, very stressful. I think in any competitive kind of TV show, I would be as hard on myself in general, but I think because I was representing the, like, always underrepresented, and I couldn't just be me, I had to be a little bit of everyone and be aware of so much. And I felt like I was very much had that pressure going in. And every single time I walked on set, I felt like I reminded myself of that every single moment. I felt like I had no room for error. And that's in my regular drag life and how I came up struggling to get on stages and knowing that I was going to get critiqued a lot harsher than the queen who just went out and did a lip sync to a song dressed in like whatever dress they just picked off the floor of their
Fashion Nova.
And that's a perfectly fine version of drag. But if you're going to compare what I was trying to do and what they were trying to do and say that I was so boring or not doing as much, it just doesn't make sense. And it all comes down to the misogyny that we have in the drag world and the queer community. It's still very apparent. It's apparent on Twitter, that's for sure. All those misogynistic gay trolls definitely show themselves and tell, just get out, leave, you don't belong here. Like, it's still apparent, and it's just not in our faces as much as it is because they can go online and say it in secret. But other than the negative part of coming up and trying to swim through a sea of haters to try to get to the fresh air, I breathed that fresh air once I was even just announced as a competitor on the season. I had an influx of love and support from so many kings that it really drowned out all those haters that were already coming. Oh, he only got cast because he's niche. Oh, here's the token. They're probably going to make him win because he's token. And like, really trying, people trying to tokenize me and just throw me that I was only successful because I was one of a few, instead of, no, I earned that spot because I definitely blood, sweat, and tears has gone into everything I've done in my entire drag career, let alone what I did in Dragula. And it's listening to critiques. It was listening to, like, how you pointed out the vampire mariachi. Every critique afterwards, and people don't know this about Dragula unless you have heard me talk about it probably, is they really care about you understanding your critiques. And if you didn't get critiques on the floor show and they told you you were safe and you left, they still called you that night or made sure to pull you aside and make, these are critiques for you. Do you have any questions? And they'll call you, like, hey, just want to make sure you understood your critiques. Do you have any questions about them? Because we want to make sure that you know what we're coming from so that you can improve and be your best. And almost every critique I got after mariachi was, just do mariachi again. Just do mariachi again. Whatever you did for mariachi, do that again. Just do that again. And I'm like, okay. So I just kept trying to turn whatever I already created and brought and still wanted to keep my perspective, but still give the critiques that they gave me and apply that to what I think they thought they wanted. And it turned out, like, I guess I did it well because I ended up winning. But the response from the kings, I've always had a great response from most kings. You know, you have a few out there that I'm not their cup of tea, and that's okay because there are a bevy of beverages you can choose.
Of course.
It's inevitable that there will be people, we know this, there will be trolls in every community.
Every community. So, but it really has been beautiful, and they've lifted me up, and I get so many, especially meet and greets, and like from baby kings or kings that maybe started right after or right before I was on, my season aired, and it's heartwarming every single time. My favorite part about travel shows are the meet and greets and meeting people and having people give me compliments. So it's always good. but I think in general, it's been Incredible. And just because you said it, and not because I know you meant it with love and as a compliment, but I really, really dislike when people call me the King of Kings. And I know you meant it with love.
I understand.
I just don't vibe with it because I can only do me. And there are a sea of incredible drag kings and drag artists out there that I cannot touch what they're doing. And it's just unfortunate that the world hasn't found them yet. It's, you know what I mean? So like, I don't like being called, I mean, it's cute to be called me daddy. Ooh, I'm daddy. I'm daddy's cider. Yeah, like, that's cute to me. But like King of Kings, I don't like.
I'm glad that you said that. And, you know, Jinx won the All-Stars, you know, and I she has a similar feeling about being called the queen of all queens.
Right.
So you're in good company. And I totally get it. I think it's that thing where we want to put you up on the highest of pedestals and your humility and your graciousness is shining through. And I'm glad that you said that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Nobody does you like you. And you, through what you just shared, you have walked the walk, you have done the work, you have carved the path. And so this is important for people to hear. And in connecting it to this week's episode, give him his gold now.
Yes.
Please.
I only won 25,000.
Exactly.
And that all gets sent back to the friends that let me borrow money to be on the show to begin with. So.
Where can people follow you? Where can they find you? Where can they support you? Where can they buy your merch and go to your shows?
All social media is Landon Cider. That's L-A-N-D-O-N, cider like apple cider. And you can find me on Instagram and I'm still on Facebook because I am a grandpa. I am on TikTok. I am on Twitter a little bit. I don't go there all the time, but when shit goes down, I like to go and stir the pot a little bit. And you can buy my merch at landoncider.com. I have shows all over. I am loving to go or do a travel gig for anyone nearby in your area. If you have a show bar that brings in out of town talents, let them know that you want me there and I'll be happy to go. I might be working on some stuff that are still kind of under wraps and I can't really give any details about yet, but I might even make some music this year. So you can Amazing. Keep an eye out for that. Yeah.
Maybe you'll do your own leprechaun rap.
Yeah, hopefully not. I don't think you'll be getting much rapping from me, but I am a trained vocalist in the theatrical style. So I'm going to try to not do like Ethel Merman, like head to toe looks, but I try to bring some of my singing that people don't hear from me very often. Unless you come to local shows, you hear me sing live.
Well, I cannot wait to hear it. And I know that our listeners will be keeping up. And I will just say that I don't think the leprechaun knew that the leprechaun could rap until the leprechaun rap.
That is true.
Landon, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Leprechaun, but more importantly, to talk about you. We are so happy to have you join us here on Midnight Mass. It was an honor and a privilege, and it always is a delight to see you.
Well, thank you.
That was the fantastic Drag King Superstar. Not King of all Kings, but the Drag King Superstar, Landon Cider. And like we discussed, it is required viewing for you to go check out his leprechaun cosplay because it is unparalleled.
Yeah, I also appreciated that we allowed the conversation to deviate a little bit to talk about the landscape of drag for a drag king such as Landon, as well as Landon's time on Dragula and sort of the aftermath of that. It's still in line with the episode because who loves a little bit of deviation more than the leprechaun?
Landon really picked up on all the fun stuff that we love about this movie. I think that we, you know that it's this unusual and strange movie that exists in the pop culture lexicon, but you go back and you watch it and you really realize like, oh, wow, this is an odd film. And the Jennifer Aniston of it all, the violence mixed with comedy, that time and place in which this film came out, it really makes it kind of this film that you can go back and look at almost like a time capsule. The way we look at, you know, early 80s horror, you know, Leprechaun is that sort of like, okay, this is a post-slasher entry doing its own thing, taking from the lessons of Freddy Krueger and Chucky and making its own splash. Landon really gets all of that.
But I think there's something special about Jennifer Aniston in this movie. She hasn't shied away from talking about it, but, you know, post Friends and post like A-list stardom, it's not a movie that she rushes to discuss. But I think that we are now in this interesting space with the final girls of horror, like Jamie Lee Curtis returning to the franchise and embracing the legacy. We see Adrienne King going back to Crystal Lake for this new A24 series. And in this sort of interest in the women who helped kickstart these franchises that we've grown up with, there's a part of me that feels like Jennifer Aniston, because Leprechaun is so tinged with comedy, she doesn't get mentioned as frequently as those others, despite being the final girl who kicked off this franchise. But she really, frame for frame, can stand shoulder to shoulder with a lot of them. I think she's a really great character in this film.
I agree. She's good. I mean, Jennifer Aniston is dismissed in my mind because she's like one of those Friends actors, you know, not someone I consider to be a great, you know, actor. But then, you know, I see something like The Morning Show on Apple TV and it's like, holy shit, this woman is brilliant. I mean, this woman is a genius actor. And you go back and watch some old trivial entry, and you know, she's not a fan of this movie. And right. What was her boyfriend's name with the huge dick? You know, the one from Mulholland Drive.
Oh, Justin Theroux. Oh my God. I said that a little too quickly for everybody.
Of course. Michael Beta, kind of a measurement symbol with his hands. So he knew exactly who I was talking about. I saw this thing where Justin Theroux was flipping through channels when they were like hanging out one night and Leprechaun was starting, and he forced her to watch it. And it's a really funny interview where she talks about having to watch it with Justin. And of course, he was loving it. And she says she enjoyed revisiting it and kind of could see the humor in it or whatever. But she is a talented actor. And, you know, we know now that a lot of our most brilliant, what we would consider A-listers, get their start in this genre. When young actors do these horror films that people roll their eyes at, especially their parents and agents and managers, it's like, go fuck yourself. Jennifer Aniston, hello. Renee Zellweger, Matthew McConaughey in the drag queen chainsaw entry, you know.
No, it's true. And I love that story about her watching this with Justin Theroux, because even if it was begrudgingly her admitting that she thought it was fun, it makes me like her even more, because you know how it is navigating the entertainment industry. And when you have movies of varying genres or quality in your past, this town and this industry really wants you to kind of just not talk about things. And we've seen how that has affected the conversation for folks like Faye Dunaway when it comes to Mommy Dearest, or how for many years Elizabeth Berkley refused to engage with showgirls and is only now kind of wading back into those waters. But I think that you, as a creative, if you understand the evolution of your career and your performance and the kind of things you do, rather than try and lock something away, if you can embrace it and appreciate it for what it is, you're going to be much happier. And I like that while Jennifer Aniston may not love Leprechaun, she at least is willing to entertain discussing it and is entertained by it. That makes me appreciate her in ways that I know other folks in this town would not engage with it in the same way.
We know. I mean, that's the business we're in. We're in the business of cult movies. And there are some people who can never sit back and appreciate the contribution they've made because they get too caught up in what the bigger industry thought of it or whatever. They don't really listen to the fans. They don't really embrace it. And that's always frustrating. I mean, how can you as a performer deliver a line as iconic as "no wire hangers ever" and not embrace it at some point in your life? But we know that that happens. So
it's true. While heaping all this love on the character of Tori, the character played by Jennifer Aniston, I think this is a natural segue into our next guest, because she penned the film Leprechaun Returns, which takes the franchise back to its roots and explores what happens to Tori's daughter when she comes back to the cabin. This person is someone I had the pleasure of connecting with when I was writing a series for Skybound, the company behind The Walking Dead, called Dissecting Fear, which looked at different aspects of how horror is made. I would write the scripts for their second season, and she was their amazing narrator. She is a phenomenal screenwriter. She is the screenwriter behind the new Slumber Party Massacre. She's written episodes of Ash versus Evil Dead. Obviously, she wrote this Leprechaun sequel. It's Suzanne Kiley. She's here right now to talk all things Little and Green with us right now. Welcome back, listeners. I first connected with our next guest a handful of years ago when we were paired on a digital series for Skybound Entertainment called Dissecting Fear that would weekly explore the mechanics of horror films. As I learned more about her amazing work outside of that project, I quickly became a fan. Her writing credits in the world of film and TV are impressive and many, including penning the critically acclaimed 2021 reimagining of Slumber Party Massacre, the murderous mascot movie Killer High, and episodes of Ash vs. Evil Dead, Dallas and Robo, Light as a Feather, and Warrior Nun. What's more, and especially applicable to this episode, she was the writer of 2018's Leprechaun Returns, which to date remains the most recent entry in the Leprechaun franchise, as well as the movie that took the franchise back to the foundations of the original. As a producer, she's worked on such projects as 13, Fear is Real, Harmony, and Highly Functional, and as an actress has appeared in Fanboy, Oz the Great and Powerful, and many episodes of Code Monkeys, among others. She's a writer, producer, actor, and much, much more. It's Suzanne Kiley. Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Yay!
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I sound so fancy when you say it, Michael.
Well, I'm just thrilled that we actually get to meet face-to-face, so to speak, because when we did the Skybound show, I would do writing and then you narrated it, but we never got to meet. But like for what, 8-10 weeks we were paired together on a show. So
I know, we were like ships passing in the night. You did a different show with them as well, didn't you? Or
yeah, I hosted an on-camera show called History of Fright with them that alas lasted one season, but still it was what it was. But I was at their offices a few times.
Well, I have to say, Michael's introduction is like such a revelation about how many different episodes we could have you on, because you're so qualified and you've worked on and created so many things that I love. I mean, your Slumber Party Massacre, you know, is just fantastic. And I just loved it so much. And of course, as the podcast is obviously a cult podcast, the Evil Dead universe plays into that heavily. You know, there's just a lot that we could have you on. But we have you here because we're doing Leprechaun. What is your history with Leprechaun and what led to you becoming part of the Leprechaun universe?
All the older movies that I love, the gems are always things that I sort of found on my own that I didn't know about. And I felt like they were some magical thing that only I knew about. You know, none of my friends were into horror movies like I was. And so I lived on this island of these old monster movies and horror movies. And as I got older and started to meet new people and move to new places, I realized there was a whole community that felt like me and loved the same movies that I did. So Leprechaun was one of, you know, the ones that always such a favorite and love of mine. And so it was a fun shock when I was working on the animated show Dallas and Robo, and my agent and manager called me at the same time. And it always means something great or something terrible. They were like, so we got this call and they're asking you to write the new Leprechaun movie. And I was like, you want me to go in and, I mean, like, do I have to pitch like my take on it? No, we think they're just giving it to you. And I was like, how do they even know who I am? And they're like, well, they saw the episode of Ash versus Evil Dead you wrote and they really liked it. And so you have a meeting next week with the Lionsgate people, the sci-fi people, the production company Blue Ice people. And I was like, okay. But I was overprepared because I was like, clearly there's some other step involved. And so I got on the call and it was like 8 people and they were like, this is what we're doing and we're excited. And I didn't say anything and they were about to hang up. And I foolishly was like, that's it. They were like, yeah, that's it. I'll send you a contract. And I was like, I prepared all these stories for you. And they were like, okay, tell us a story. And of course, then I told this like terrible story that nobody wanted to hear, that had like apropos of nothing. And it was crickets. And I was like, I just had this moment, I'm like, well, I just talked myself out of a job that I clearly was just being given. But thankfully they did send the contract and I did get the job and I did get to write on it. And it was such a joy for me because I truly do love the series. And so it was fun for me to put my own spin on it.
Well, what I really love about that movie coming out when it did, you make it and it comes out in 2018, is around that time when we also got the return to the Halloween franchise. And they made a lot of noise about the fact that Halloween was going to take it back to the original. We're going to like kind of eschew the sequels. And it's like the original is canon and this new movie is canon. And in some ways, that's kind of what you did with Leprechaun Returns. But you couldn't have had the foresight of knowing that Halloween was going to do that, because I imagine you were probably making them around the same time. So what made you decide to do that? Because it seemed, interestingly enough, prescient for the way horror was going.
I would love to say that that was my idea, but that was the only directive that I was given, was to make it a direct sequel to the original. You know, they're like, just send us some ideas. And I did. And my favorite was the one that they ultimately chose and what you see in the movie. But the directive was, we want to do a direct sequel. So unfortunately, it wasn't my brilliant idea. But I will take credit for it anyway.
As a writer, I would imagine in some ways, knowing what they want, a little bit of it might have helped, you know, tackle it. In fact, I think it was a good idea. I mean, I think the Halloween, what you're seeing with, you know, your Leprechaun or Halloween or Scream or any of these is like, fans want that connection, you know, to the original. Actually, the new Hellraiser is really interesting as well, because it is connected to the original, even though it doesn't feel like it. But it's connected in a way that is tonally connected. A lot of these franchises, let's face it, kind of jump the shark repeatedly, right? And so fans are kind of like, let's skip all that stuff and go back to the original. So when you were rewatching the first one or getting to know it, I would imagine it's sort of like when I create a stage show of a movie, I have to watch these things and kind of live in them and get to know them. So what inspired you most about the first one as far as what you were going to bring to your version?
You know, not to be depressing, but the funny thing was that I immediately knew what I wanted to bring, because at the time that I was asked to write the movie, my mom was in hospice. She was dying. And and so I immediately just sort of connected with this idea of a woman wanting to know about her mother and wanting to go back to this place where she knew something happened and was never able to get that information. So I just love the idea of a woman going back to a place where something significant happened to her mother and learning about that and what happened to her. And yeah, so that's sort of immediately what came to me at that too. And I think the other thing too is, you know, the Tori in the Jennifer Aniston's character in the original is sort of that 90s lady character. I just saw Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom, and it's the same kind of thing where it's like the lady who can't stand bugs and spider webs and just wants to go back to her fancy city. And so there was something I wanted to do where these women are the opposite, where they are going in and this is what they love. They're ready to tackle, you know, all the issues at this house and make it better. And they don't need anyone else to help them do it, that they're the drivers of this house and what they want.
When looking at Slumber Party Massacre as well, those scripts have that kinship in common. I wonder, when you take a legacy property like Leprechaun or Slumber Party Massacre, now, obviously, we know there's a lot more there with the history of Slumber Party Massacre being the only franchise that has been driven by women creators. We know that there's a lot of subtext in that original movie, but bringing it to the new era, if you will, you did bring a lot of extra commentary and things that are going on today. Leprechaun, I feel in some ways, was probably trickier, right? Because on surface, it is sort of silly. But you were able to really look at that and see there is a generational story here. This is more than just about the legacy of sequel. It's about the legacy of people and how people evolve in situations. To borrow a Jamie Lee Curtis term, there's the trauma that travels downward.
She loves that word.
She sure does.
You've seen those clip reels, right, of her saying trauma like 1,000 times. Anyway, I digress.
Right. Was that particularly important to you to make sure that when going into a territory like Leprechaun, you still had something to say?
I think so. I think, you know, all of us as writers have to do that, even if you don't, you want to honor your source material and still have fun. I love Leprechaun. I love the series. I think when you were talking earlier about not knowing Halloween was going to do, going back to the beginning, I think the fun thing about Leprechaun, each one of the movies is of its time and of what was in at the moment. And Monsters in Space was a big thing. And even Origins, you know, that was a time where it's like, this is about just a horrible monster that's attacking, that has no personality or whatever. And so they were all sort of their time. And so
In the Hood.
Yes, In the Hood. You know, it's like,
that was a thing. You know,
which is so good. I just rewatched that. God, it's so good. I swear, the one thing I will say is all the movies, they just got the best casting directors because the actors in these movies are
amazing,
better than they need to be for these movies, for the Leprechaun series. Mm-hmm. So yes, I wanted to bring what was important to me and what I enjoy, but also to really honor what's so fun about the movies, and is that they are absurd, and you can still make a fun movie and have those elements in it. You know, it's like, that's to me what I love horror comedies so much, because it sort of reminds us that if we can laugh at our fear, then it isn't so scary. And if as silly and as campy as a horror movie can be, if you love a character, then you root for them and you don't want them to die. And so there's always stakes, no matter how silly or campy or over the top a horror movie is. And so I think, you know, you can't go wrong. If you have a good monster and one good character, you know, you're set.
For sure. I mean, I think horror is beloved for so many different reasons, and there's so many different styles of horror. And I think Leprechaun, interestingly, is this sort of weird mashup of so many different things that were going on in the genre. I mean, it's part slasher, it's part magic, it's part silly and camp, you know, like it knew what it was, but it's also very violent and gory. And, you know, there's just a lot of different things going on. And that leads me to my next question, which is Leprechaun does, like many of these films that have had, you know, a franchise built around them, you can only have a franchise if there's a cult. And we're a cult podcast. And, you know, Leprechaun clearly had enough of a cult that it spawned, you know, a number of sequels. And now you're reimagining. And so I'm wondering, what has it been like engaging with the cult? Do you read stuff online? Are there Leprechaun fan clubs? You know, I'm not as tapped in, but obviously there's got to be folks out there who are really, you know, connected to this franchise.
Yeah, and passionate and small but mighty, as the Leprechaun himself.
Yes.
Mostly people are really positive. And again, like, that's the nice thing about this franchise, is because every movie is so different, that there was sort of more range of what you can do, because every movie was, I think, written and directed by a different person and had the same monster, the same sort of idea of greed. But at the same time, there was a lot of open space to do, you know, my own thing. And for the most part, I've gotten over the years very good at tuning out negative criticism. Good criticism is great, whether it's positive or less than positive. But I'm pretty good at just ignoring things that are hateful. But for the most part, everyone was, except for like one person that messaged me to say that I ruined their childhood, everything else was super positive.
That is exactly the kind of thing that I love, because if your childhood was dependent on your love affair with Leprechaun, then you are definitely a part of that cult. And maybe you should look at that a little bit, you know, just a little bit.
Well, it's a wider fan discussion that I think we need to address anyway. I love when people use that phrase, because first off, that gives us as creators way more power than we need in your life. That your sequel to a movie that was made 30 years ago ruined someone's childhood makes you that person's boss in some way, because they basically gave you the right to ruin their childhood, air quotes. And like, what's that even mean? I don't know. That's a whole other episode.
I just want passion. If it's either like passion because you love it so much or passion because you hate it so much, wonderful. Anyone that's just middling, like, it was fine. That to me is the worst thing anyone can say, is like, it was okay.
We make our stuff for people who love this stuff. And so if they're angry about it, I mean, I would be interested to know why that person was upset at you and how you ruined their childhood. But who cares, ultimately? What I found is in the horror genre, much like the wider world that we live in. And of course, this podcast is a great example of this. Growing up, a child of the 80s, and being obsessed with Fangoria and going to horror conventions and feeling alone, there was no concept of queer horror. If you were queer, you were not openly gay. Clive Barker was not openly gay. Don Mancini, I did not know, was gay. You know, there were these people. Women weren't allowed to direct or write or make horror movies. You know, they were living in the shadows. Queer people were living in the shadows. Certainly, there was no Get Out. There was no, you know, there were very few Black people invited to the table. So it was a, let's face it, it was a straight white male dominated universe. And I am a fan of so many of these straight white guys. Don't get me wrong. That is not a problem. But at the end of the day, there is this sort of thing where I feel like there's this last gasp of some horror fans who don't want us to take a seat at the table. And you kind of can read between the lines. You know, especially when my film All About Evil came out, they basically would write around the fact that they'd say too queer, you know, don't like it, too queer, but they can't say that. So there is this part of them that probably misses the Jennifer Aniston character being scared by spiders and, you know, so girly. You know, it is an interesting thing when we're allowed to participate. There are always going to be some people that just don't want us around, you know.
And it's such a bummer because that's the most wonderful part about horror that's coming out today is because there's so many different voices. There's so many new surprises that, you know, I'm still being surprised and scared because it's changing so much that I'm getting different points of view. I'm getting different scares. I'm getting different characters. And that makes it so much more exciting and so much more interesting that something you think that is going to remain the same has opened up in a whole new way. And it's exciting. That's the great thing about the fandom too, is I'm hearing, you know, following different people and hearing about what they love. And I'm just been getting introduced to so much new horror that's so exciting.
Agreed.
Speaking of possibilities in a different way, one of the things I was really excited to talk to you about from a writer's perspective is often when we're tasked to create stories that have these sort of like fantastic lenses, we're sort of given the directive, you still need to establish the rules, right? What are the rules? What can the character do and what can't the character do? But the Leprechaun is essentially a character who can do anything. And so I'm wondering, is that in itself tricky or is it just fun? Like, because you know that no matter how outrageous a kill, it's possible in this universe.
The one great thing about Leprechaun is one of the hardest things, as you know, writing a horror movie, is like, who is your monster? And so being able to go in and already knowing who the monster is so great, because one of the hardest things is already figured out for you. There's pros and cons to having a monster that can do anything, because you can, you know, you don't want to make them so unstoppable that your characters have no chance of winning, but you also get to play and do anything. I used to do, you know, improv and sketch comedy. And one of the things that I loved, you know, in improv is that wherever, you know, you're like, oh, you're in a kitchen or you're on a farm or you're, you know, in a restaurant, wherever it was, you know, you have to look around in your mind and think of the things that are in that room for like the fake props that you're picking up. And I try to do a similar thing with murdering people. What, you know, room am I in? What kind of place is this? And what would be in that place? And is that something that could murder someone? It turns out that you can murder someone with anything, which is great. So I tried to approach it more of like, what could the Leprechaun use to take people out? And what can they use? And really used what was in the original movie to what can they use to fight back? And it was, you know, interesting. I friends of mine, when I was working on the movie, I went to dinner at their house and my friend Eric is a contractor. And so I was like, okay, these are women that are, you know, building a house. Like what are, you know, I really sort of, I was like, if you're building an eco house, what are the things that you would use? What do you need? And he was actually like, you know, gold is a conductor. And I was like,
that's so great. For the hardcore fans, another thing that's been lovely about these legacy sort, I don't know, what do we call these the new version is going back to the original roots, is that they should follow the rules of the original and they should use what was introduced in the original, because that's what the fans are looking for, right? And that the sequels often diverted into territory that the fans didn't really want because they weren't staying true to what, you know, they fell in love with. Now, for the listeners at home, we do our interviews on Zoom, so I can actually see, you know, Michael and Suzanne, and I can see Suzanne's last name, and I can see that she's a redhead. And now it's occurring to me, I think maybe she's Irish. And I thought to myself, like, did, you know, one, are you? And two, culturally, you know, in an era of, let's just say, like, we're being more sensitive to the ways we present different cultures and things. Like, did any of that come into your mind? How do Irish people feel about Leprechaun, the movie? And what is your experience with that culturally?
I will speak for all Irish Americans, and then how can you not love the Leprechaun movie, you know?
Yay. It's a positive representation, yes, of Irish. Certainly more positive than those, you know, Irish parades trying to not include queer people or whatever. You know, Leprechaun's a much better representation.
Exactly. You know, he's willing to kill all. It doesn't matter who you are. He will murder you.
Exactly. There's equity,
yeah,
there.
And what's fun about the movies, too, is thinking about it, is like, he's got one drive. He wants, I guess, in the first movie anyway, he wants his gold. You know, he's very motivated in that.
Yeah.
And what's fun, though, is that it really does talk about capitalism, because it's everybody else wants it too. You know, everyone else, they're no better than he is. They want their this gold, yeah, too. And people are, you know, they see it, and you can't help but get money signs in your eyes. And I think that it says something, too, about sort of society in general. You know, is sort of that we all are willing to face the leprechaun if it means we can get that gold. And it never ends up well. And it never ends well for the leprechaun. So, you know.
And I don't know where I thought we were going to go with the conversation, but I guess I was not really planning on it delving into the dissection of capitalism in the movie, but it makes so much sense, doesn't it?
It's an allegory about greed. If nothing else, what is capitalism's, you know, fatal flaw, you know? And we are really living in the shit show of the result of, you know, just unbridled greed. I mean, when you look around at the world, the state of the world, and look at what the billionaires do with their money, and, you know, I mean, Leprechaun's actually a perfect, you know, horror movie to revisit at, you know, at this time. You know, I think in the 90s, it was maybe a little more pure, a little more simple. You know, the 80s were kind of what gave birth to a lot of the problems we're experiencing today. So maybe it was a little too early, but now it's like, oof. Gold is a great device for a horror movie. I think most normal people can relate to being fucked over by people's greed.
Yes. My new favorite genre of movie is really terrible rich people getting their comeuppance.
Yes. The Menu.
Like Triangle of Sadness.
Triangle of Sadness.
Which frankly could have used a leprechaun. I'm just going to say it.
Parasite.
Bodies, bodies, bodies.
Suzanne, because we talked about the limitless potential of how a leprechaun can kill, I'm going to ask, my mom calls this the Fangoria question because she's endlessly fascinated when we talk about slasher movies that Peaches and I ask people this. But I was like, Mom, this is the Fangoria question. People love this. Do you have a favorite kill over the course of the franchise? And what was the favorite kill of yours that you wrote?
I would stick with the original, because I think the pogo stick is such a great and unique kill. And again, like, I love that it was coming from he was like in a weird pawn shop. And so of course there was this random, if you can kill someone with a pogo stick, that I've got to come up with something I've got to top it. And so I think for me, it was the solar panel splitting him in half.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, it's really great. I know that we've talked a lot about your participation with the cult, about the leprechaun, but I was really excited when you started to talk about the modern horror movies. This is something we often do on our Patreon, because we tend to cover things that are cult and canon and, you know, built up. But I, like you, am so excited about horror right now because of the new voices, because of the new directors and writers and creators. So before we wrap up, I'm just wondering, like, what have you seen recently that excites you? You know, I know we just listed the a bunch of rich people movies that we're all excited by. I know that I've spoken on the podcast, I believe recently, about the fact that I really can't stop thinking about that movie Speak No Evil, which I saw on Shudder. So if you haven't seen that, I really recommend it, because the horror there is really about trusting your gut versus being polite. Really, it's like fabulous. Like, just that concept is what carries that movie. But I'm wondering if you've seen anything recently that you just loved.
My favorite movie of last year was Nope.
Ah.
I just thought it had such an incredible statement about celebrity and identity and the film industry and taking control of your, even in a situation where things are so terrible. It's like, even if you don't have much control, it's like you get to take control of your situation and in this monstrous thing, and you get to make a buck off of it. Nobody else does. And I just loved it so much. And I thought it had so many different and unique perspectives and ideas about all of those things.
It also had one of the scariest moments in film for a movie that's not really a horror movie. I don't want to give any spoilers away, because there is a great twist in the film that I did not see coming that is just genius and actually made the whole movie like, oh my God, that's so smart. I never considered that that's what that could be, you know? And I hadn't seen that concept before. But the scene that just floored me was where the, and I think it was CGI, but it was so realistic, but the monkey and the little boy under the table.
Yes.
It was just, oh my God, I think I stopped breathing, you know, watching that scene.
Me too. It was incredible. Yeah. It was so shocking.
Yeah.
It's such an iconic, cool moment.
Listening to what you said about the reasons you like Nope, I also, though, of course, noted that it has some of those anti-capitalist sentiments. So I'm seeing a trend here. I'm seeing a trend.
Yeah.
So for our last question, I'm going to take it back to the topic of the day. And it's something I like to ask all of our guests, but this, I think, will be particularly unique because of your own journey crafting a legacy sequel. From the time that you first saw Leprechaun to then, you know, having to plot and scheme a story that carried on that story, has your relationship with the original movie changed, if at all?
I obviously watched it a bunch before I started writing the movie. And there's always this moment where I have, where I want to like honor the original and do things that were in the original that I'm, you know, nodding to in, you know, that and even Summer Party. But at the same time, you don't want to write a movie where you go, well, if you see the original, you'll really get this. It needs to sort of, you know, stand on its own. And so when I was watching the original this weekend, I watched it with my husband and stepson, who had never seen it. And so it was really fun to be able to sit there with them and watch it again and forgetting things that I saw in the original. I was like, oh yeah, I did kind of nod to that. I forgot I did that. I was reminded of how delightful and charming all the actors were and how important that is in a movie, from Warwick Davis to Jennifer Aniston and
Francis.
Yeah, Mark Holton. That was my great joy, by the way. This is an aside, but my great joy, the moment when I was writing the movie and I had written that character as someone else. And then after I wrote the first draft, I was like, oh, why is this not Ozzy? Like, how is this not Ozzy?
Yeah.
And I emailed everyone. I was like, you don't have to pay me. I'm going to write it as him. For him, and I don't care, because if you can't get him, fine, I'll redo it. That's on me. But I'm writing it for him, and if you can get him, do. And he read it and agreed to do it, and so that was such a joy for me.
He's so great. Every time he shows up in a movie, I'm just tickled. You know, he's just one of those great character actors who's had one of those fabulous careers, hasn't become a household name necessarily, but is just, we is so beloved, you know, from film fans. And I had forgotten that he was in Leprechaun because I saw Leprechaun when it came out. What I really remembered was, you know, Jennifer Aniston and Warwick Davis, and rewatching it, you know, to do the podcast, I was like, oh my God, I'm so excited. And then, you know, that he's in the new movie is just so fabulous. Yeah. So, well, where can people find you? I actually just followed you on Twitter, so I know you're there. where are you active on social media? People want to keep up with you.
I'm terrible at keeping up, but I do love going on Twitter and Instagram and, you know, reading other people, and I will always respond to people mostly. But, oh, you know, and so at Twitter, at
unless you Suzanne ruin their childhood.
Pine. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm cool with that. yeah, so I think Twitter and Instagram, it's at Suzanne Kiley.
Well, Suzanne, can't thank you enough for coming on the show. You've been such a fabulous guest, and we hope to keep in touch, and long live Leprechaun.
He doesn't die. Thank you so much for having me. I had such a great time.
That was the fantastic Suzanne Kiley, who Michael knows I fell madly, madly in love with. This was a guest who Michael had known previously, but I had the pleasure of meeting through the podcast, and I just loved talking with her. Oh my God, she's one of the many guests I would love to have on for a second episode, just because of how much I enjoyed talking with her. Oh my God, great conversation.
What I really love about Suzanne's body of work is that she has been able to take these classic horror films and icons and look at them through the today lens while also applying that reverence. Slumber Party Massacre is really a great new approach to the material while also kind of recognizing this post-meta horror space that we live in. By considering Leprechaun Returns as a continuation of the original movie, she presupposed what Blumhouse was doing with Jamie Lee Curtis. You know, it's sort of really cool to see her work in the space and how it both is celebratory of the horror of always, but also really on point with the horror of now. And I think that's great.
Yes. Slumber Party Massacre, the new movie that she made, was so embraced by the horror community. And it's so clear that this is someone who knows how to inject new life into a genre or into an existing property. Wow, I just loved talking with her. Now, there is a sort of guest that's going to be saved for a Patreon exclusive. Michael is actually working on putting up an exclusive interview on our Patreon. If ever we, you know, could promote the content that we have properly, this is now, because this is a very exciting exclusive. It's an exclusive for our Patreon subscribers.
At the beginning of the episode, Peaches and I both acknowledged that this particular installment of Midnight Mass was a long time coming and it had a few hiccups. And so for that reason, both for ourselves, for our guests, and for our listeners, we wanted to give a little extra something. And Peaches and I were able to sit down with Barry Barnholds, the producer of the original Leprechaun, someone who I have been fortunate enough to work with in my own career. He's produced a number of television movies that I have made. And Barry did a interview with us about kind of discovering the movie, how Mark Jones brought the Leprechaun into his office and sold him on the idea. He talks to us about rolling the film out into the middle of the country to gauge its reaction, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really cool interview.
Let's spoiler alert. Just one of the little tidbits that I thought was so great was he talks about one of the first test screenings where it baffled him that the audience was laughing.
Yes.
Which I love. And you're going to get some great intel like that.
This is a very special and a very unique interview because it's a print interview. So I'm writing it as if we were doing it for Fangoria or the Wall Street Journal. So frankly, this is Peaches and I attempt at getting a Peabody Award. You're welcome. Barry took some time out of his day to sit down with us, and we have the transcript. I'm putting it together. And that is an extension of our celebration of Leprechaun, and it will be on Patreon the week of this episode's release. So if you're interested in going a little deeper and hearing from the guy who greenlit the film, who also is behind thousands of other movies, many, many of which I know you love. You probably want to subscribe and check it out.
Yep. And in addition to the big Patreon plug, this episode comes out before some nerd-like appearances for both Michael and I. So if you are a listener who's planning on attending either Midsummer Scream in Long Beach or Comic-Con in San Diego, Michael will be at Comic-Con, Peaches will be at Midsummer Scream. Who knows? Maybe one or the other of us will join us at the other. But we know for sure that this is the schedule. So look for us at those upcoming conventions in July.
In the meantime, I think that we managed to take this long in production episode and make some gold.
Yeah, that's right. So if you too are a unapologetic, money-grubbing, money-hoarding, money-obsessed, greedy little magical creature running around screaming, "Where's my gold?" Well, then you too may be one of the children of the popcorn now.
Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.